So I actually spend a little bit less than half of my time on peculiar velocities these days. I'm spending more of my time on lensing, both from our own survey, which is called now Unions. It's a survey of the Northern Hemisphere and Euclid. But because of the interest here, in particular in kinetic Sinyia-Zeldovich effect, and the fact that most of the faces here are new since the last time I gave this talk, or an earlier version of this talk maybe 4 years ago, I thought it might be better for this audience to talk about peculiar velocities, because there are things happening there as well. And in particular, you know, in the current age, everybody knows about redshift space distortions. Some people know about kinetic Sinyia-Zeldovich effect, but nobody actually knows. I shouldn't say nobody. Many people don't know about the sort of more classical way of measuring peculiar velocities, which, of course, has a long pedigree. So I'm going to introduce you to what you can do with that and try to convince you that you can actually do very competitive cosmological tests with it. So I'll give you a short intro. I'll spend most of the talk focusing on a particular method that we use, which is comparing the matter density field, which we infer from the galaxies, to the measured peculiar velocity field. And I'll spend a little bit of time on future prospects. This will be split up into two parts, the old way using linear theory and the new way using a forward modeling method that I'll describe. So peculiar velocities have a long history. Hubble was aware of them, although in his case he was thinking about the peculiar velocity of the sun with respect to the center of the galaxy. But it was still a term he fit for when fitting the Hubble expansion. Of course, we all know that the local group is moving with respect to the CMB, and that's been pretty much known since the early 70s. After the CMB was measured, the next thing they looked for was the dipole. I like to mention that this is not an intrinsic dipole. Some people say, well, how do we know that it's not intrinsic to the CMB fluctuations themselves? And that's been demonstrated in particular in this paper, which looks at the aberration of the CMB fluctuations as a function of angle on the sky and gives you an independent method of the dipole rather than just the temperature itself. So that's noisy, but it agrees with the standard measurement. And so a long-standing question has been to understand where this comes from. What is the source of this 600 kilometers per second motion? On what scale? Another way of thinking about it is, how far would you have to go out for that motion to disappear? In other words, on what size of the scale of the universe do you get a volume which is at rest with respect to the CMB? And then, of course, in a universe with fluctuations that are diminishing with scales, it'll never be perfectly at rest, but it should asymptotically approach zero on some scale. So we'll shed a little bit of light on that as well. All right, so three ways of measuring peculiar velocities. The classical way, the way that people are more familiar with now, using redshift space distortions. And of course, many people here are well aware of the kinetic Sinyia-Zeldovich effect is a new way of measuring peculiar velocities. But I'm going to focus on this one, which at low redshift boils down to this. Okay, so the peculiar velocity is just the measured redshift minus the velocity that the galaxy would have had if it's expanding with the Hubble flow. All right, and another hang-up that people have is, does this depend on H naught? And the short answer is no, because what you really measure easily empirically is this combination H naught R, right? And the reason for that is a peculiar velocity techniques, which are all empirical, measure relative distances. And the way that they typically do it is not measure relative distance with respect to some local calibrators, but rather measure relative distances to some distant shell of distant objects, which are assumed to be expanding on average with the Hubble flow. So you're doing an inverse distance ladder going from a higher redshift back down to lower values. That means the natural units for this are kilometers per second, not megaparsecs. You can, of course, calibrate them if you want to by stepping down to local calibrators, but it's not necessary. And classically, this was never done in the old days, because there weren't very many good local calibrators until fairly recently. So that's the CZ is the easy part, as you know, and it's the H not R part, which is difficult. Primarily three methods have been used. Classically, the methods are Tully-Fisher and the fundamental plane. For those people who don't know what those are, they're empirical relations that galaxies follow. Spiral galaxies follow the Tully-Fisher relation, which is a relation between luminosity and the line width of the galaxy. The line width is distance independent. The luminosity, of course, is, well, the magnitude is distance dependent. And so that empirical correlation, you measure the line width, you get the absolute luminosity. You measure the apparent magnitude, and the difference between the two tells you the distance. Okay? Tully was at this meeting that I was just at, and for years, Tully would, the only person in the world who would refer to this relationship as the luminosity line width relationship. But the most recent meeting I saw him at, which was just a few days ago, he said, this relationship which seems to be named after me. The other empirical method that has a lot of classical use is the fundamental plane. So that's a relationship that elliptical galaxies have between their central velocity dispersion of their stars, the surface brightness, both of those things distance independent, and the half-light radius, okay, which of course is a distance-dependent quantity. And finally, many people are familiar with supernovae, standard candles. Right? So these two are good to about 20%. Supernovae between 5 and 10%. Supernovae are much better in principle, much more accurate. The problem is we can't control when they go off. And the supernova rate is roughly one per L-star galaxy per 100 years. Okay, so to cover the entire nearby universe with a supernovae survey, which will be lovely, we'd have to wait much longer than the average graduate thesis time. Nevertheless, when you do get them, they're powerful, and we'll talk about those today a little bit. So these methods, you get this to 20% or 5%, and that you can see the disadvantage of this is since it's a relative error, as you go to larger distances, the uncertainties are also going to increase. Okay, so it's really a method that works best as close as you can get to the origin. And as you go out, you have to get increasingly large numbers of objects to beat down the error per object in kilometers per second. Okay, a reminder, most of you know this, but it's good to just remind you. I like to show the analogy, right? We all know how to calculate accelerations given a matter density, right? And peculiar velocities, if you haven't thought about it this way, are just like that, except now we use the perturbations, okay? And they give us the peculiar velocities with some extra factors in here. So the delta you all know, and the delta goes in here. So you can use all your intuition for calculating accelerations to peculiar velocities as well, which is the nice thing. And of course, as you also know, the F is this logarithmic growth rate of the perturbations, scaling like omega matter to the gamma, where gamma is 0.55 in lambda CDM. So in principle, the goal is to measure this quantity here, and that could be a test of omega matter or gamma or some degenerate combination of both. So you could, in principle, use it to test alternative gravity theories. One other point worth mentioning here, if we write all our distances not as distances in megaparsecs, but as h naught times r, i.e. in units of kilometers per second, then this H naught drops away, and this also becomes independent of the Hubble constant. And again, that's what you measure from the redshifts most easily. All right, so I'm going to talk about some very recent work led by Supranta, who's sitting in the back row there. Collaborators Guillaume Lavaux, who's now at the EFPA, but he was a postdoc with Nyesh and myself at UW, and he was also cross-appointed here. So some of you may remember him. Anybody remember him? Not you. I know you guys do. Okay. The senior people remember him. Jens Jasch is in Stockholm. Okay, and they're mostly involved with the second part of the comparisons, which I'll mention later. So let me take you through the classical way of which this is done. But to do first, to motivate it, I'll remind you that there's some tension in sigma 8. Okay, so this is sigma 8 versus omega matter, showing this is an older plot from 2014 showing Planck data. And even back our old weak lensing survey called CFHT lens, there was a little bit of tension there between that data and the Planck data. So that could be systematic errors in either of these two data sets, or it could be new physics. Current lensing data, the tension hasn't gone away. So this capital S8 parameter is essentially a scaled version of this to take away the curvature. So it goes like sigma 8 times omega matter to the 0.5. But no matter how you plot it, there's still a little bit of a hint of tension between different data sets. So again, this is now newer Planck data, and maybe just look at the pink, which is a combination of a survey called KIDS and first year of DES data combined together. So again, this problem still seems to be around, which suggests that it may be not systematic errors in lensing, at least. These independent data sets are showing the same thing so far. It could be the same systematic error, but it's not something tied to a specific data set, I guess is a fair way to put it. it could be some common error in the analysis or something like that in principle. So is there another way we could measure this? And obviously the answer to that is yes. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to start with the galaxy density field, which we're going to assume linear biasing holds. Okay. And so I'm going to take that and plug that into the previous equation. So that's the fluctuations in galaxies. All right, and then we get a B that comes out. And so this gives us a degenerate factor in front, which is usually called beta in this field. And because our data doesn't go to infinity, there's an extra term that contributes to the velocity from outside the area where our data is. And we're going to model that external stuff as a simple dipole. Okay, and the reason for modeling as a simple dipole is the edge of the data is at 200 H inverse megaparsecs. The actual data are more like within 50. So any higher order moment should be very small for this stuff centered at the origin. Okay, so this is good. That's now based on the data. And this we're going to measure directly, not through redshift space distortions, but have direct point by point measurements from these distance indicators. Okay, and so the key will be to compare observational measures of this, observational measures of that, and infer these quantities here. We can turn that into some more useful parameters. Okay, if we're assuming linear biasing, then the sigma 8s are linked together, and we can substitute in for the B and write this combination F sigma 8, same thing that was plotted in the previous plot, effectively, with two parameters that are measurable from data comparisons, this one, which we get by comparing data and data, and this one, which we can measure by looking at the fluctuations of this field. Okay, so that's the idea, at least in linear theory, and I'll tell you the nonlinear version of this in a second. Okay, so to apply linear theory, though, we don't want to just plug in arbitrary values of delta, which are in essence a series of delta functions, because this is based on linear theory, and we want linear theory to work. And linear theory doesn't work on small scales. So on what scales does linear theory work? So we've tested that with n-body simulations. This is work led by one of my graduate students, Amber Hollinger. And what we've done is gone into n-body simulations, where you have halos, you have the particles, you can calculate the deltas directly, okay? And then you can try different choices of smoothings. And you can compare the slope of the regression, observed meaning n-body, divided by prediction, given by smooth linear field. Okay, and if you don't smooth enough, then you get a relationship with a lot of scatter, a lot of noise, and that gives you a biased slope. If you smooth too much, then you smooth out some of the structure, you're flattening out the predictions, and you get a biased slope. But the answer where you get the right slope is about 4 megaparsecs. Okay. Yes.
And the prediction you're comparing to from linear theory is the smooth prediction.
The smooth prediction against unsmooth data. So the data are an inhomogeneous and noisy set of measurements distributed in the universe. You could try to smooth those, but it's a pain in the. I shouldn't say anything because we're being recorded. You know what I mean. It's difficult, and people have gotten into trouble trying to do complicated smoothing, especially because they're not parallel when you're close to the origin, and it hasn't worked very well. So we're taking a different approach. We're taking the raw, unsmoothed data and comparing it to the predictions of a smooth field. Okay, and calibrating that with n-body simulations, where in n-body, the data are just the measured peculiar velocities of a set of halos.
So if I were to interpret that, you're determining the right theory prediction that's appropriate to compare to the measurements.
Correct. So since I have to smooth the predictions, okay, what scale should I smooth them on? Gaussians are nicer than top hats, right? So if I wanted to minimize the scatter, I might go for 3 megaparsecs, but I'd rather be unbiased, so I go for 4. All right, and now this measure, this residual scatter, 140 kilometers per second is not bad, actually, because the typical distance errors, typical objects maybe 40, 50 megaparsecs already have errors due to the estimates of the distances, which are 20%, and that's 1,000 kilometers per second. So in either case, this is much smaller than those. So we have smoothed our data, this data on a 4 mega with a 4 H inverse megaparsec Gaussian to get our predictions, the predictive peculiar velocities, which we're really going to compare with the observational values. I'll say a little bit about the data. So we use this compilation of data called 2M++. It's because it's based on the 2-mass redshift survey, 2MRS, which is the red stuff. But then where their better data exists, we've supplanted it with a survey called 60F redshift survey and a Sloan digital sky survey in these two areas. Okay, and the reason that we need to do it this way is that we want to predict peculiar velocities of objects which are close to the origin. And so we want an all-sky survey. We want the integral in the previous case to be as close to all-sky as possible. All right, so when you do all that, this is what the data look like. This is work by a previous student, John Carrick. So it's, of course, a 3-dimensional volume. This is a slice through a plane called the supergalactic plane, smoothed with, in this case, for visual purposes, I think it's a little bit more than 4. I forget the exact number. So where there's no data, it's this uniform blue at 0, under dense regions, over dense regions, very high density regions up in red. So the names of these objects, and there are many more, are those. This is the cosmography part of the talk. Okay, so we live here at 0, 0, right in between this and this. That's Virgo, that's Fornax cluster. So we have Virgo here, we have a region here, which is called the Great Attractor region, which contains a number of rich clusters that was important historically. There's another supercluster a little bit further away called Perseus Pisces. All right, and then we have this big object called the Shapley concentration, which is much further away, but much more massive. And so here's where you can use your intuition from normal gravity. Think about these things as point masses, and with a mass and a 1 over r squared. Okay, so Virgo is very close to us. It's low mass, but it's close, so it actually has significant impact on our velocity, about 200 kilometers per second. This other region is relatively massive. It's relatively close. It's closer than this one. So after you've accounted for Virgo, there's kind of a tug of war between these two systems. And this one wins, not because it's much more massive, but because it's closer. It wins the 1 over r squared. Shapley is very massive, but it's about 3 times further away than this, but it lines up in the same direction, so we get a vectorial pull at the end of the day in this sort of direction, from here up, slight diagonal this way, and more or less in this plane. And I'll tell you what it all adds up to in a second. So the idea is you take this density field, smooth it on the appropriate scale, plug it into the formula, predict the peculiar velocities. And then you compare it with the observational data sets and just fit for those 3 parameters. Before I go there, I'll just show you this little animation because this is a 3D thing. And if those who people who are keen can go on Sketchfab. All right, so this is a nice site where you can take the 3D density field and then you can rotate it and zoom in and stuff like that. So that's what a Gaussian random field looks like once it's smoothed out. If you don't smooth it enough, it gets very confusing and complicated because there's too many blobs. Right, so you need to smooth it and throw some kind of threshold over it. I'll go back for a second, just so you can see this plane here is the supergalactic plane. All right, so it's local, but it's not the only thing that's going on. There is a planar structure there, and you'll see it as it rotates when it rotates 180 degrees. All right, so it's there, there again. Whoops, I don't, still there. All right, so there is a plane there, but there's nothing super magical about it. I think it's just a chance coincidence. But it goes down to very small scales, which is why de Vaucouleurs knew about it in the 60s. Includes Virgo, for example. All right, so we take this 3D density field and we make some predictions. So we have data set that we want to compare to, so the galaxy density field's going in here, and then we're going to compare to the peculiar velocity data. So we, so far we've used an older data set, but still a large data set called SFI++, which is a Tully Fisher data set of spirals. So each of these is good to about 20%. And they're typically at a distance of about 30 H-inverse megaparsecs. And now Supranta has compiled a new collection of supernovae. There are now about 450 of those. They're also relatively local ones. We're not talking about the high redshift ones that they use for the accelerating universe. We cut it to be data within our volume. So these are much more accurate, between half to a quarter of the error, so they have a lot more weight. So these have roughly approximately equal weight at the end of the day. Okay, and so when you put it all together and plug it in and do the comparison that I described and then calculate F sigma 8 as I described earlier, you get a value which is about 0.4. You get error bars which are very small. Okay, so that's key point number one. This is a direct comparison, right? RSD people say, well, what about the volume you're surveying? It's a cross-correlation. There is no cosmic variance in this. It's a, just a direct comparison. The only cosmic variance that's in it is how you normalize the velocities in a volume of 200 H-inverse megaparsecs and the densities in the same volume, right? Because we're taking a local sample and we're assuming that the average within 200 is the same as the average globally, right? And that should be good to, you know, a fraction of a percent, not the dominant source of error. Modulo systematic errors, of course. Okay, so that's what linear theory tells you. And now I'm going to move on to the other approach. So how can we do better? Let's go back a little bit for a second. No, I don't want to show that again. So this equation is linear. The whole equation is linear theory. And we're also using linear, we're assuming linear biasing to relate this to the fluctuations in the mass. Okay, so the new approach, which is called BORG, right, which stands for Bayesian Origin Reconstruction from Galaxies. You know, I used to like the old-fashioned way, but over time I've come to see this approach. It's a big, powerful machine which seems to just eat everything in its way, and apparently resistance is futile. So the way this works, which is computationally complicated, but in principle has power, is instead of doing an inverse statistical model where we start from the data today. So I didn't tell you the story of how we actually go from redshift space back into real space. In the linear way, we do it with an iterative method. So we assume the peculiar velocities are zero, the galaxies are at their location in redshift space, then we slowly turn up the F factor or the beta factor, calculate a peculiar velocity based on redshift space, and then use that to correct the redshifts and get the galaxies back to their proper position in real space. And you can do that for different values of beta, and that gives you a self-consistent density peculiar velocity map for each value of beta that you might care about. Remember, beta is that scaling factor. Okay, so that's an inverse method, going from the data, applying some transformations to get back to what we think is the truth. So this is a forward modeling method, you know, and it's based on an MCMC code, which is called Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, which makes some uses some tricks to get a high acceptance rate, put it that way. The Hamiltonian comes from conserving an energy in a certain type of space. But in this method, we're going to actually guess the initial density, either in Fourier space or in grids. So there are a lot of free parameters. If it's a 256 cubed, there are 256 free parameters to guess. 256 cubed, sorry, did I say just 256? Okay, I misspoke. Yeah, that's a lot more. Well, it's a real thing, so we don't have to worry about the twice, right? So we guess the initial density, then we have to predict the final density, all right? And right now we use second order Lagrangian perturbation theory to do that. In principle, you don't have to do that. You could use a full n-body simulation. But since you're running thousands of samples, that's quite expensive. And there is a published version that Lavoe has where he uses the low-resolution PM simulations to do this. So the idea is you start with your initial density. Those are your initial conditions. You predict the final density, and now you can go beyond linear theory. That's, in principle, the advantage. But of course, this predicts the mass fluctuations. And what we observe are galaxies. Okay, so we need a model that models somehow the bias of the galaxies. And in this implementation, that's a fairly flexible form, which isn't required to be pure linear biasing, but has a function as a function of the luminosity of the galaxies. And those are treated as nuisance parameters included that you marginalize over. Okay, so each choice of the bias parameters in the 256 cubed produces a self-consistent density, self-consistent at least as far as 2LPT goes. Self-consistent density and velocity field that are consistent with the galaxy fluctuations. All right, so this is work primarily done by Lavoe and Jens Jasch, and now Supranta is applying this to these kind of comparisons that we're making now. Okay, so yes, resistance is futile. We have to accept this. Right, and the same group, I'm not directly involved in it, but Lavoe and other collaborators have applied this to, for example, the BOSS survey, and presumably will apply this machinery to other future surveys, such as the data become available. All right, so this is how it looks visually. So if we compare the other method that I outlined at 4 H inverse megaparsec smoothing, which we're calling inverse modeling, that's the same supergalactic plane you saw earlier with some structures labeled. This forward method produces this as the mean field. Okay, it's called this Borg method is this forward method. This is smooth with a 4H inverse megaparsec. This is predicted with a 3H inverse megaparsec voxel.
Okay,
a cube, a grid cell. Instead of a pixel, which is a 2x2, it's a three-dimensional pixel, if you want to think about it that way. It has a volume in it.
It has a radius of 4 or a diameter?
This is the size. This is a radius of a Gaussian.
So the Gaussian smoothing is really 3 times bigger than the Fox smoothing.
That's right. So I'm going to get to that in a second. Hang on a second. Okay. So this is just that. This is how it's done natively. All right. Now, if you smooth it with a 10 megaparsec Gaussian for both to put them on the same scale, what you see is the same gross features. Okay, so there's a lump there, there's a lump there, there's a lump there, a lump there, a lump there. But the contrast is different. All right, so the fluctuations here look smaller than they do here.
So, question.
Yeah, you first, I guess, even though you had your hand up first, but he can't see you.
So, I mean, would we make a difference with a median versus mean of the density?
I don't know. I suspect not. Hopefully everything's close to Gaussian, but I'm not sure. The main issue here, and we're still trying to understand why it comes out a little bit lower, and I think that fundamentally what's going on is that into the so far in this reconstruction, let me go back two steps, is only the distribution of galaxies. So even though the biasing is somewhat nonlinear, there's still a fundamental degeneracy that is hard for the galaxy data alone to break. Okay, so the way in the future to go, I think, to go is to fit the galaxy density data and the peculiar velocity data at the same time, simultaneously. But we haven't done it.
So my question was a little similar to the edges, but we can extend it a little bit. The advantage of the sort of Bayesian method is that it ought to give you a full proper posterior that you can sample.
Right.
And then you can assess how significant is the contrast difference? How significant are some of the filamentary features in the higher resolution?
Indeed. And in fact, there's a third panel which I cut off, which I'm now regretting doing it, which has at least the RMS of this map.
Right.
And what it shows you, I can tell you qualitatively how it behaves. When you have a large structure, of course, the uncertainty in it is large. But also, where there is data, the fluctuations are low. And where there is no data, the fluctuations go to the prior, right, which is a lambda CDM prior, which has gone into that. It's missing from the previous description. Okay, so the initial waves that you choose here are drawn from a lambda CDM distribution. That doesn't mean the recovered fit obeys lambda CDM. They just act like a prior.
And I guess my other question is, are there any regularizers or additional bi-priors that are applied to the reconstruction, or is it
just the lambda CDM power spectrum? Right. That's basically it. That regularizes it. So an individual realization, if I could have shown you one, would have all sorts of random stuff out here where there's no data. But if you average over the ensemble of those, then it should go to zero, right? But with a high RMS. Where the data is, then the features should be stable, right? And you could even, we haven't done this yet, you could make a little movie jiggling around different realizations. They should be more or less stable. Of course, they're still uncertain where the density is high, but you could assess visually. And in general, the RMS where the data is low, and it's high outside. Okay. So the problem that we have at the moment is that the fluctuations here are low, I think, because galaxy is not breaking, just the distribution of galaxies is not fully breaking the degeneracy. So at the end of the day, we allow a free rescaling. So that would predict peculiar velocities, which were low, because it's closer to smooth. And so again, we allow a free rescaling factor to fit the data. Yeah?
You shouldn't use this figure as fluctuation, because it's a mean, so this underestimates the fluctuations.
It'll underestimate the fluctuations, but if any fluctuation we put in will add noise.
Right.
So this will give us the minimum variance compared to the predictions.
Right. That's right.
That's,
and if you want to get, say, estimate of the power spectrum, you would actually.
If we want an estimate of the power spectrum, that would be true, right? So we've rescaled the velocities to allow us to rescale up the contrast, essentially. And so this table shows you the comparison for three different peculiar velocity data sets, okay, with two different methods. What you get, just focus on this one for now, for this combination of F sigma 8. Okay, so to first order, there's a reasonable consistency between different data sets and the final value, and between the two, all combined is just obviously taking all these collectively. So perhaps partly by good luck, because if you look at individual ones, this is an upward fluctuation here, whereas that's a downward fluctuation. So the data is the same, the methods are different. And I'll come back to talk about these columns in a second. So that's encouraging. We still have the scaling factor, but it's encouraging that if we allow it to rescale, and remember there's a free rescaling here, so in some sense it's fair, we can get reasonable values of F sigma 8. Yeah.
So the difference between those two images you showed before seem way different than like at the percent level as we're seeing.
Right, because once we take this map, so let me go back to the equation here, okay? So this is what we used in linear theory. We said there's a delta galaxy with a bias, right? Now we say there's some delta field supposedly of the mass, but it could still be biased, right? It's not galaxy bias, but it's biased in the classical statistical sense. So we allow to readjust. There's a contrast level that we allow to readjust, but the data can fix it. And the same argument we made for linear theory with just a linear rescaling works the same way. What we would like to do, as I said, is to fit them simultaneously so that we fix the sigma 8 level. This shows that when rescaled, it gives you comparable values. To put it a different way, if you measure sigma 8 for the light, okay, directly off the data, you get of order 1. Yeah, that's the sigma 8g that I had in the previous equation. If you estimate sigma 8 for this mass, you don't get 0.8, you get something close to 0.6. It's too low in contrast, okay? But because we can measure that off the field itself, the same way we measure the fluctuations of the light, this same argument that we did here still works, because we can calibrate this degenerate combination with the data themselves.
And so that's what you're not supposed to get sigma 8 from the maps. So that's what you're just saying here. You're underestimated if you're going to use the mean map.
Think of this as, instead of G, replace that with Borg.
Yeah.
Okay? So there's a sigma 8 of the mass, which is too low, because the Borg is unable to break the galaxy bias degeneracy. In other words, it has a best solution, but it's converged on a value which is systematically off. Okay, but I can still measure it from the area where there's data. Okay.
One question about the global model. So how's the bias modeled?
No, it's not as sophisticated as a Halo model. It just assumes that there's for different cuts of luminosity, there's some kind of probability of seeing an object of that size. And that's a free function, which is still somewhat constrained. It's a power law with an exponential cutoff in the voids. So it has a little bit more freedom than simply linear bias, but not much. Okay, and that's fit individually to different luminosities. So those are the nuisance parameters. And we're exploring different ways of doing that, including going towards a Halo model. There's another paper by Charnock et al. Which tries to fit that function using a sort of neural network machinery. But we haven't applied that here. All right. So the data at the end of the day, like similar values, whether we're using a linear theory or this sort of adjusted nonlinear theory. All right, so how does this fit in context? Better speed up a little bit. So it's nice to see F sigma 8 from different measurements. So of course the CMB tells us what that should be, right? So there's Planck, okay. The cluster abundance can, in principle, tell you what, as is well known by a person in the third row back from me, can tell you what sigma 8 and this combination of omega matter is. I don't remember, little and something. Forget the reference. So these are modern applications of that. The lensing stuff I showed you already. And there's one other data point that I didn't show you from the Hypersuprime cam, which is a bit higher. And then different ways of getting it from peculiar velocities, redshift space distortions. Okay, so this is a survey in the very nearby universe, close to redshift 0. Problem at redshift 0 is there's not much volume there. And remember, as you know, redshift space distortions are limited by cosmic variance. So you need large volumes. Okay, so BOSS, this is the most recent BOSS results, gives you this number. And then peculiar velocity surveys, these are some other groups, okay? And then these two are this work here. All right, so the takeaway message that I want you to remember is that this is based on 3,500 peculiar velocities, Whereas this is based on 1.2 million redshifts. Okay, and that's because that's limited by cosmic variance. That's, I don't know, that's just a straight average of some sort, an eyeball average, is it? For reference?
It's like my 0.4.
Sorry?
It's like my
0.4. 0.4, okay, so it's just 0.4. It's kind of some kind of average, maybe, just to guide the eye.
It's worth discussing a bit more, because if it wasn't for the Planck point on the left, that line would be going through every single one of these data points.
Correct.
Which is quite extraordinary.
Correct. That is correct.
Because these are one sigma error bars.
Yes, that is true. Now, not a few of them are not completely independent. I think most of them are independent. But you could maybe delete this one, because this is just this and this combined. The rest of them are quasi-independent.
So don't you find that's a bit odd?
Yes, but perhaps people are being conservative and putting their error bars.
But it doesn't go through all of those.
It goes through almost all of them. Maybe this one's a little bit off, right?
But the worst is not that people are underestimating the error bars, but the people think they know what the answer is.
Yeah, well, usually when that happens, they go up here. Right? That's generally the sense of confirmation bias. People say, oh, Planck must be right. Therefore, you know, blah.
Well, you need to see them in chronological order.
Yeah, well, I think
rather than
all of these ones are post-Planck. These two are, that one is certainly post-Planck. These three, I'm not sure about this one, are all post-play. Yeah, Planck has been public. It hasn't, although that is, the, you know, there's Planck 2018, the number hasn't changed much since Planck 2013, or whatever the first one was. Okay, so I wouldn't say we're at the level where we fully understand all the systematics here to 1%. But I'm showing this because I think it, in principle, is a promising method that's not limited by volume. All right, and has potential to have very low error bars. Yeah?
So what's the bottleneck? Is it computation? That's why you only use 35 velocities?
That's the state of the data.
Well,
let me back up a little bit. There is another survey, 60F, which has been analyzed. I'm not 100% satisfied with the predicted peculiar velocities out of that. So I would like to do some little more work on it before we use it. But basically, 60F has 9,000. Of course, it's deeper. So if it's three times deeper, you scale up on average every error bar by a factor of 3. That's the root n problem. It doesn't scale exactly as root n, because bigger n means going out further. But I do think it has potential, and I think it's not, with work, we can continue to understand the systematics, and with accumulated data, we can also beat down the uncertainties. Yeah, the statistical uncertainties.
So the external.
I'm getting to that in a second. Can you hold your question for a minute? All right. So, the V external. So, there's another statistic commonly used in this field called the bulk flow. The bulk flow is just what you would imagine it to be. It's just an average of the velocities, all right, in a survey. And so these are a bunch of, these data points are a bunch of measurements of that from different peculiar velocity surveys. 2MTF is a Tully Fisher sample. WFH is Watkin, Feldman, and Hudson. THF is Turnbull, Hudson, Feldman, et cetera. Okay, that was supernovae. That was a compilation of data. 60F GRS is this redshift fundamental plane survey that I just mentioned. So the green bar is kind of what you expect in a lambda CDM model. And you know, 10 years ago we found this result, which was a little bit in conflict with lambda CDM, suggested that things may be interesting on large scales. Subsequent analysis by us and others gave lower values from different data sets, suggesting this is at least in part just a statistical fluctuation. Okay, now the curves here, oh, sorry, we should probably add to this plot the local group, which of course is at 0 and up here at 600. So it's a little bit high for Lambda CDM, but not that exceptional. And then from this data set, with this full flow model, including the V external, you can predict what that should be, right? So the density field makes a prediction for the mean flow of all the galaxies inside the volume from the data inside the volume, plus the model of the stuff outside the volume, which is the V external. Call that the residual bulk flow. Okay, so you can predict that, and the two different methods predict these two different curves, all right, which both predict something close to 600 and then dropping. All right, now out to about 100, that's probably okay. If we wanted to extend this beyond 100 out to 200, maybe the simple V external model is not quite right. There could be octopoles and other things as well. So in principle, the model just predicts this goes flat at infinity, but we don't expect that to be true at very large scales. Okay, so the bottom line is from this work is there's no significant conflict with Lambda CDM at the moment. If this did continue, if observations showed this did continue to be relatively flat while this is declining, then there may be some tension, but it hasn't been confirmed, I don't think, by any data sets yet. Now, you may be aware that on very large scales, there are some measurements which are very controversial. There was an original KSZ measurement by Kashlinsky, right, which predicted it was 1,000 somewhere way out here. With Guillaume Laveau, Nyesh, and myself, we actually set an upper limit from the kinetics in Yevzeldovich by comparing our maps WMAP data, and those set an upper limit of 500 on similarly large scales. And there's been a bunch of papers trying to measure this in different ways, particularly looking at dipoles. I think we had a talk from Dragan at one point, right? So you can look at the dipoles of distant samples and try to measure the reflex motion of the local group, not with respect to the CMB, but with respect to a set of galaxies, radio galaxies, optically selected galaxies. And some of those give persistent high values, which are not understood. Okay, so I think what's going on out here is still a little bit uncertain, just from purely empirical standpoint. Obviously, if someone was going to measure 500 on some very large scale like this, then it would be a problem for Lambda CDM. And there are measurements which claim that. No. Now, the systematics, you really have to have excellent, exquisite control of the systematics to measure, for example, a reflex dipole. For example, if you try to do this with Sloan galaxies, which I did have a student try to do it many years ago, the 1% photometry errors just kill you. Right, so you have to control your fluxes to exquisite precision because the amplitude of the dipoles are very small. Yeah?
I was just going to say, how is it better to try to get this bigger, maybe at 100 or lower, because of what this thing you mentioned, that there is higher order performance in the external one. So it's basically you're underestimating that or at larger arcs, right?
Probably true. Okay, so that's the status of the bulk flow in the V external business at the moment. It does mean that at the end of the day, out of the 600 kilometers per second motion of the local group, I think we've explained all but about 150 kilometers per second of it. But 150 still remains to be explained, right? Which is what it says here. All right, I should wrap up. So it's around 150, and those missing sources are presumably either beyond 200 megaparsecs or in the zone of avoidance, right? The galactic plane, of course, maps, screens out our measurements of the map. It's hard to get redshifts, although there are efforts to get redshifts in the plane through H1 surveys. But it tends to be very hard work. I'll skip a discussion of the velocity power spectrum. I'll just show you one other application of this before we wrap up. So we're using this to measure cosmological parameters, but we have a map which predicts the peculiar velocity of every galaxy. Okay, and so people who want to measure the Hubble diagram through different techniques, even through measuring the size of the black hole shadow, need to correct for the peculiar velocity. All right, so they can take our model as given and just plug it in, All right, and so this is used by supernova teams, for example, regularly use this, as well as people now using it for gravitational waves. Okay, so in other words, they want to correct the CZ they measured for the V peculiar, and they don't care about where that comes from, so long as it's the right answer. Right, so in this case, the V peculiar is coming again from this model. So that's a sort of an application of it. We're not directly involved in it. We just publish our data and let other people download it and use it as they choose. Okay, so I should probably wrap up there, just say a word about the future. The future is always better data in cosmology. All right, and better data in this case means a survey called Taipan. So Taipan is an Australian survey using the Schmidt telescope there with a new fiber positioner. And it will measure, it will do a Sloan-like redshift survey in the south, but it will also do a fundamental plane survey. So fundamental plane's better than Tully Fisher, because Tully Fisher, you either need a radio telescope to measure the line width, or you need a slit to measure the rotation curve. Whereas with fibers, you just need to put a fiber on the center of the elliptical galaxy. And from that, you get a central velocity dispersion. Your photometry gives you the other two parameters. So Taipan is a combined peculiar velocity and redshift survey.
Do you happen to know how many fibers they have?
They're still installing them. I believe the first target is 150. And the next target will be 300, but that's if I remember correctly. They got to get the 150 working first. It's a big, it's still a 6-degree field, but it has a new spectrograph. Okay, so it's designed for sparse, nearby bright objects. And it's only on a small telescope. But nevertheless, it can do a Sloan-like redshift survey, which you can still use to measure BAOs and whatever you want in the low redshift universe, but also a fundamental plane survey, and the target is to get 50,000 fundamental plane galaxies, which would be an order of magnitude increase over what's available already. Okay, so the goal is to get that F sigma 8 number down to of order of 1%. Okay, so with better all sky redshift surveys, so if we combine Taipan and DESI, for example, especially the DESI bright survey, not the boring one at higher redshifts. Sorry, Will's not here. Okay, good. that will give us a good map and allow us to extend the density field out further. Right, but we also need large peculiar velocity data sets. So as I mentioned, Taipan. There's an effort in Australia again called Wallaby. You know, the Aussies like to name everything after an animal. A Taipan is a kind of snake, by the way. Wallaby is being done at ASCAP, which is the SKA precursor. And this will, I forget the exact number, but it'll measure tens of thousands of Tully Fisher measurements. And of course, LSST and so on will continue to accumulate supernovae as they come in. All right? But the key with all this is to be able to control the systematics to better than 1%. Okay, because if you're at 0.1C, 1% is 300 kilometers per second, which is a big systematic. Right? And that's why, for example, you've never seen any fundamental plane work come out of Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Because the velocity dispersions and the photometry are not controlled to 1%. You know, for various reasons, velocity dispersion measured on one run can differ from the velocity dispersion on another run by 1%. This could be the positioning of the astrometry or the positioning of the holes in the case of Sloan. It could be the seeing, other effects. Right, so you need to be able to do some kind of Uber calibration to get rid of those systematics before you do this, which so far has not been applied to Sloan, probably because they don't have enough overlap. Newer surveys with overlap will be able to do this. All right, so the takeaway messages, I'm out of time. We get good constraints on this thing from only a small number of peculiar velocities. I wouldn't say there's any strong evidence of problems with lambda CDM just yet, aside from these papers on very large scales, which give some interesting numbers. It looks like we've probably explained most of the local group's motion. And the takeaway message is you need numbers, but you also need systematic control over your data. Thanks.
Maybe I didn't
So fingers of God, when we start off with a redshift survey, we just group them. So we use a grouping algorithm to collapse our clusters into single objects.
Okay,
and so now that gives us a halo.
It's a mean velocity.
Right, and so remember, so are you talking, maybe let me back up. So for making the density field reconstruction, we collapse the fingers of God, and then we use linear theory on the halos to move the halos around. Okay, and then smooth the whole thing with a Gaussian. For peculiar velocities of clusters, again, we identify the objects in the same cluster and we average the distances. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you had a table of measured parameters that you shot past. I'd like to look at it again because I think I have a question.
Sure.
It's about 10 slides back.
That one, maybe.
Yeah, so most things look quite consistent, but I'm looking at the VX.
Yep.
So inverse all combined 147 plus 17.
Yeah.
Org all combined 2.
So these are
very discrepant in a way.
Yep. They're formerly inconsistent. That's right. They're formerly inconsistent.
So then, like,
neither of them are big, but they're larger than their quoted error bars.
Yeah. So are those determinations not also degenerate with F sigma 8?
There is some degeneracy.
So that would mean
but
that
it's,
anything that removes that discrepancy will pull apart the F sigma 8s and not necessarily.
It's possible. Yeah, that's right. In general, there is some coupling. It's not super strong, but there are some correlations. So we haven't, in other words, well, Supranta can tell me, is this the marginalized value over all values of Vx?
You mean the Borg value?
Yeah, is this number here the marginalized number over all of these?
Yes, that's right.
But if we were to say that these errors were slightly underestimated, because the difference is like 60 and the error bars are more like 17, and you puff this up, then how much would that go up? A little bit. Yeah, unfortunately I don't have it in, I didn't have it in my slides, but my recollection is it's mostly uncorrelated, but there's weak correlation. Is that right? Yep.
The correlation is not visible by eye.
Okay.
If you do continue to see, so your very last slide has a potential but small tension with lambda CDM. If you continue to see that, you are only having a combination of F and sigma 8, you don't know where the tension is coming from.
Yeah, the tension, there's no tension in F sigma 8, but there is, as I said, from this data, I don't think there's anything conclusive, but from other data in the literature, there are some hints that on large scales, things may be not behaving very well. So if we go back to this diagram, you know, originally we found this, then other data sets found lower values. If you go over here, then the error bars are much bigger, and the systematic error bars, which are not usually quoted, are some very large number. But there are lots of people reporting very large numbers, which I don't think have been fully digested. Likewise, if this were to continue on flat, then maybe there'd be a little bit of tension with lambda CDM. So I think I put that in there because I think it's still worth exploring, but I wouldn't panic at this stage. If you put all your money on lambda CDM, then don't remove your bet just yet. But on the other hand, there's something for everybody. On the other hand, if you bet against it, you have hope.
I guess what I was saying is a combination of gamma and sigma 8. So you have to assume either modified.
That's right. That's right. So,
and you study sigma.
That's right. So the null hypothesis here is lambda CDM with the lambda CDM gamma, etc. If you did find convincing evidence that something is weird on large scales, then you know, I will show, since you've asked, the plot that I bleeped over, which was from another group, right, where they try to measure the power spectrum, the velocity power spectrum directly from two different data sets. So just ignore all these weird curves, except for the black one, which is the lambda CDM power spectrum. And so they've binned it in, they've tried to do a binning by wave number. So all of these data points are more or less consistent with Lambda CDM. On the very largest scales, smallest k, well, again, maybe there's a little hint that something's a bit weird, right? From two different, these are independent data sets. On the other hand, these error bars probably don't fully include systematics. Yeah?
So the tension really is the tension to find. And you're showing that, you're showing a sigma for, it's not for a B bar, but it's for
So there's this tension on large scales, and there is a tension with Planck on F sigma 8. Is it significant? Well,
I mean, you could average all these.
Ours by ourselves, probably not significantly different. If you do the eyeball averaging of everything that we described, then maybe. Yeah.
I think that's probably. So a related question is that this tension in the external, why don't I see it in this V-ball plot?
You don't see it in the V-ball plot because I haven't plotted any data over here and I haven't extended this. Right. If I let this go flat and let this go down, then the tension would be more obvious.
There's a tension between the two methods, right?
No, I mean between either of these, this one's higher than this one, and this green curve. So if, for example, I'll give you a specific example. If you calculate what this V external should be, how much of a contribution should come from Lambda CDM, and I've done this calculation, it's in a different paper, from outside a 200 H inverse megaparsec sphere, okay, then Lambda CDM predicts from outside that sphere 40 kilometers per second in each direction. Okay, so in 3D, put in a root 3, you've got maybe 70 or 80. It's closer to 70, I guess. The number we measure is more like 150. So it's a little bit on the edge, but the caveats are, that's a naive analytic calculation. The real data goes out to 200 around most of the sky, but one part of the sky, it doesn't go out to 200. Plus, we're missing the plane. And I don't really want to do that integral, so.
How plausible is it that something in the plane will adjust the velocity in the correct direction? I can't.
So funny you should mention that. There's a conference coming up in South Africa on peculiar velocities. And one of the people who's involved in organizing that, René Krahn-Kortweg, has done a survey of a supercluster, which is hidden right here. So it's more or less in the right direction. Her claim is that it's at least as massive as Shapley, but completely obscured by the plane.
So it is plausible.
It is possible. Now, if you try to attach numbers to that in a very hand-wavy way, you don't get 150 kilometers per second. You could maybe get 50 of that 150.
Which is enough, given your argument for the beyond 200.
Which is enough, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's possible there are still undiscovered structures in the big structures in the plane. Now, you might ask, if you have a whole bunch of big structures on this side of the sky and no big structures over here, does that indicate power on large scales? Which is your question about, would you expect it to line up? Observationally, it seems to. A priori, it wouldn't line up unless you had big fluctuations, some very large-scale density waves.
You can also ask whether it aligns with the CMB power asymmetries or not.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the CMB asymmetry. I'm not sure
about
that one.
Direct.
That's in the ecliptic, so I haven't worked that out. Thanks.